Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of the program, we will return to a topic that we have discussed before in the show. We'll be talking about Syria. The government of Syria is facing the greatest challenge to its authority in something like 40 years. It has been estimated that over the past year, more than 8,000 people have died in anti-government protests, and at least 14,000 people have been arrested. In this hour of the show, we are very pleased to have here in studio with us Joshua Landis. He is Associate Professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He's been with us before on the show to talk about Syria, always on the telephone. He's visiting the campus to give a talk, and we're very pleased that he is here with us in the studio. This is a talk in the MillerCom series. Many departments are contributing to this, but his main host is the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. And he'll be talking about Syria this afternoon at 4 o'clock. The talk takes place at the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana on the U of I campus. And these programs are always free and open to the public. So if you're interested in hearing from him, you can stop by this afternoon at 4. But we're also happy to give you the opportunity to call in with questions this morning on the program. So 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. So if you would like to use that, if it would be long-distance call, that's 800-222-9455. And there is email, so you can be involved in the conversation that way. It's will-talk@illinois.edu at any point here. Questions are welcome.
David, it's so good to have you here. It's a pleasure to be here. We've done this on the phone a number of times, but this is much more fun.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. We're very, very, very happy to have you here. We've talked now several times about Syria, and certainly a couple of times over the last year since things have exploded. And I think last December, I know that there were some people who were looking at what was going on there and that were saying, well, we were on the verge of civil war in Syria. And people continue to use that terminology to say that we're there or we're close to there. Have we, in fact, arrived at that point? Is that what this is?
There certainly are elements of a civil war because the regime and the president, Bashar al-Assad, he's an Alawite, which is a offshoot of Shi'a Islam, esoteric religion. And he has stuffed the top ranks of the military with co-religionists and other sensitive ministries. And that's led to the fact that the Syrian government there haven't been widespread defections in the top of the military. Mm-hmm. And the military is a reflection of the president. So this is not like Egypt or Tunisia, where the military is turned against the president. And they're fighting, and the rebel forces are largely Sunni Muslims. So that's the civil war part of it. On the other hand, it's not clear, right now the president and the military is smashing the opposition. The opposition went off, showed its faces, wasn't really very – they thought the government was going to collapse. They thought that the army would defect, that this would be over in a matter of months. And they went out and took over center cities in places like Homs and Idlib and showed their faces. The military didn't collapse. And in the last several months, they have been smashing the opposition and doing classic clear-and-hold operations, just like U.S. forces in Iraq or Afghanistan taking areas back and hunting down the insurgents. And it has been very bloody. But I think that Assad believes that he's winning this, and he has kept the support of the Russians and Chinese, who vetoed any effort by the U.S. and Europe to condemn Syria in the United Nations. And the international forces are – nobody wants to get into Syria. It's not a Libya. It's not 6 million people with the government hanging by a thread and half the country already in revolt. It is a big country of 24 people. It's an ethnic stew. And the military is still very strong. So to get in could be a situation like Iraq or Afghanistan where you don't know how to get out once you get in.
Yeah. And I think that, we've certainly, one of the things that you have said and when we've talked before is that when, and I've asked this question about, well, what's likely to happen and could the government fall? You said, well, what's really critical here, as you just said, is that the president and the government continues to have the support of the military. They hang together. And I think a lot of people have looked at it and said, well, the reason that they hang together is that they know that they'll hang separately if they don't, because they are on the same side of the sectarian divide as the president and other people in the government are. Having said all that, can you imagine, though, any circumstances under which the military would break with the government? Or is that just such a remote possibility you just would say that's you would almost be willing to say that's just not going to happen?
I don't think it's going to happen. A lot of people in Washington do, and they're trying to find, people to make a coup. And you hear people in the think tanks talking about there's going to be a coup and we just have to add more pressure. But they've said that. In 2005, after the Hariri killing in Lebanon, when America, George Bush, tried to put pressure on Syria, it hasn't happened. And this government has been in power for this dynasty. The Assad family has been in power for 40 years now. And everybody has constantly been talking about coups, but they haven't happened. They've figured out how to coup-proof pretty well. So to gamble on a coup, I think, is unwise.
Well, in his public comments, I think President Assad has been very consistent in talking about the fact that he said this opposition, this was not internal. It was coming from outside of the country. He said he was battling terrorists. He has said that he was not killing his own people. In fact, he said in an interview that he did with Barbara Walters now some months back, he in fact said he wasn't even in control of the military himself. So you read comments like that, and you have to wonder, what exactly is this man thinking?
Yeah, well, this is a grassroots revolution. This is an uprising of Syrians, and he's trying to, sweep that fact under the rug. Now, there is an element of, obviously, foreign assistance for the rebels. Saudi Arabia would like to very much overturn this government and put in a Sunni government, have the Sunnis take over, because then they would be anti-Iranian and that would help them in their struggle. Many people in the United States are saying the same thing. Assad has been a pain in the side of the United States for decades. This is a pro-Iranian regime. It supports Hezbollah. It is very resentful of Israel that occupies a hunk of Syrian land. And so there are a lot of reasons why America would like the government to fall. On the other hand, they do not want to see a civil war. And that's, they don't want to see another Iraq-type situation next door, because if Iraq were to slide towards civil war, and that's not impossible, and Syria at the same time, it would be very destabilizing. A lot of refugees, and there are many people who don't want to see that. On the other hand, they do want to see Assad go. So there is a foreign element, but this is a grassroots uprising. There is no doubt about it. Assad is trying to put he's trying to make it into this foreign conspiracy. There's a little bit of truth to that, but he's dressing it up in order to hide what is an internal revolt.
Are there ways already in which this has spilled over the borders of Syria?
It has. Well, there's been plenty of refugees going to Turkey, 20,000. Yeah. There are quite a few thousand in Lebanon, and we just read about recently 2,000 have turned up in the last few weeks in Jordan. So it's beginning to have effects. On the other hand, many people have been saying, oh, there's going to be a regional war, everybody's going to be sucked in. They said the same thing about Iraq before the U.S. went into Iraq. I think people are trying not to get sucked into this. In fact, there's been too little, if you will, from the revolutionaries' point of view, outside assistance. And Turkey and Saudi Arabia have been very loath to really send in arms and to get involved, because they're not sure that the opposition is going to win, and they don't know, and the opposition is very fragmented. They don't know who to arm. That's been a real problem.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of focus is Joshua Landis from University of Oklahoma. We're talking about Syria and current events there. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe it would be interesting, helpful for people if you talked a little bit about how it is the Assads actually came to power. The father of the current president, Hafez al-Assad, he was in power from 1970 until he died, 2000. And then power passed on to the current president, even though that wasn't always the plan. There was another son
who died
in the car crash. He was the guy that was supposed to be the next guy in line. Well, that didn't work out. But so regardless, we have this dynasty now. And as you explained, that they are indeed part of this minority sect, the Alawites, who are only 12%, I think, of the population. How is it that the current president's father
came to power? How the Alawites were the poorest, least educated element, community in Syria before the French took over Syria in 1920. So it is quite an astounding rise from being at the very bottom of the Syrian society to being at the top. At least a few of them are at the top. There's still tons of poor Alawites. But I guess to give context, this whole Levant area, Iraq, Palestine, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, was taken over by the British and French, who divided it up and created nation states after they conquered the Ottoman Empire in the First World War. In 1918, they dispatched the Ottoman Empire, and they divided this big multi-ethnic empire up into nation states. They did it fairly arbitrarily, and they stuck these different religious communities inside the borders of these new nation states. And that has caused a great deal of trouble in the region. Then they ruled the area until the end of the Second World War themselves. And in order to do that, they had to put down lots of Sunni Arab uprisings against colonial rule. The way they did that, rather than send all their own boys over there to get killed, they armed up local armies. And they drafted tons of minorities into these armies who would be willing to shoot at the Sunni Arabs because of bad blood going back centuries. And the Alawites, being the most forlorn community in Syria and picked on community, went into the military in big numbers. So it was over-recruited into the military because they wanted a uniform and 3 square meals a day. So when the French left in 1946, by 1956, some people say that 60% of the non-commissioned officers were Alawites. They went up the ranks. Syria was very unstable. When the French left, there were a series of coups, and the Alawites went up the ranks. By 1963, they had formed a secret military committee and were really in charge through coups of the military. By 1966, they took over directly. Salah Deed, the first Alawite to take over, and then there was some fighting amongst them over which family was going to rule. And Assad came to the top in 1970, and he instituted a family, very narrow family rule, using his in-laws, his brothers, to staff the security forces and starting to coup-proof this so that it wouldn't be unstable. And he brought stability to Syria, but the price of dictatorship, very narrow government, and he has ruled the country ever since. Of course, he's ruled it in alliance with other groups, but the security forces, largely Alawite.
Yeah. Now, I think that it is true that he continues to have the support of a lot of the elites in the country, people within the business community, and people who live in the bigger cities like Damascus and Aleppo, places like that, that haven't really been touched very much. Although within the last less than a month, there were two big car bombings in Damascus, which maybe we can talk about that. But who is it that, other than the military, who is it that are the important supporters of President Assad now within Syria?
Well, there's the sectarian element, but there's also a class element, as you've underlined here. Mm-hmm. The big cities, Damascus and Aleppo, which provide, with all their suburbs, about 50% of the Syrian population, have been spoiled, have been privileged. Most of the business, most of the economic growth has been in those two cities. The rest of Syria has been largely ignored by the Syrian regime, and particularly the countryside. When the Ba'ath Revolution first took place in the 60s, it was a revolution of these poor rural elements, and they brought schools. It's like the Cuban Revolution. They brought schools, clinics, and electricity to the countryside, and that was the big accomplishment of the sort of socialist rural revolution. But they quickly ignored it after that, and then things became corrupt and stagnant. The countryside has undergone a population boom. 50% of Syrians are younger than 23. Rural poverty has been screaming up. The UN in 2010 estimated that 32% of Syrians lived in poverty, and they defined poverty as $2 a day or less. Now, that's probably up close to 50% today because the Syrian pound has collapsed. It's gone down about 40% since the uprising started and the sanctions have set in. So there is real deep poverty in the countryside. Joblessness is huge. Lots of young people with nothing to do and no future. And that's the recipe for this revolution. But it's also a reason why the urban upper classes are frightened of it. They're worried that these hordes of unemployed youth, if they win this revolution, will come to town and make a mess of things. So they don't like the regime because it's Alawite, it's corrupt, so forth. But they've learned to live with it, and the regime has bought them off and is just beginning. Assad, the younger Assad, Bashar al-Assad, who took over in 2000 from his father, was brought up in Damascus, good schooling. He's a spoiled kid from the big city, like these old Sunni elites. And he's become part of them. And he was opening up the economy and privatizing. And once, you know, in the last 7 or 8 years, this old Sunni elite that had been the wealthy of Syria, had been very sort of moth-bitten over because of socialism, was beginning to once again reclaim its glory of the old days by opening private schools, starting factories, big malls spreading around, new, all kinds of shops and imports. So they are reluctant to go to the unknown, and they are really worried that it could turn into a civil war and they'd be like Iraqis. And in Iraq, the upper and middle classes have left the country. That's been the strategy. And that's, I fear, what will be the strategy for the upper classes in Syria, is that they're leaving in droves. They're waiting till the school year ends in Aleppo and so forth, particularly the Christians and other minorities. But they're trying to find a way out to go take their kids to Lebanon or Turkey or Jordan or the West if they have relatives and start a new life.
Yeah. So that dynamic would, given that dynamic, particularly between this class dynamic and between the big city and the rural area, maybe then it wouldn't be surprising that the place where this all started was down in the south, in this place called Deraa, which is near the border with Jordan. And this is, it's an agricultural area. It's poor. So these would have been the people who, if anybody was going to have a grievance, it would be a part of the country like that.
And Idlib, Homs, this provincial third city, but it's got a big agricultural hinterland. And it's also mixed, Alawite and Sunni, so that causes the ethnic tensions are there. But Idlib in the north, big agricultural, very poor. The suburbs of Aleppo, there's a lot of desperation. And Syria and this government has failed to produce the kind of economic growth that Syria needed.
Just again to introduce our guest in this hour, we are talking with Joshua Landis from University of Oklahoma. We're talking about Syria and recent events there. He's visiting the campus. We'll give a talk this afternoon. Questions here, welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. About 2 weeks ago, maybe a little bit less, there were these two big car bombs that went off in Damascus. And while there had been some events there, I don't know that there had been anything of this scale before. Is that something that is likely to get people in Damascus thinking about, you know, whether or not they want to continue to support the government?
Well, that's the big question. You know, unnamed American sources in the New York Times said that they believed this was al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And Zawahiri, who's now the head of al-Qaeda ever since bin Laden was killed, has given statements supporting the revolution in Syria, asking people to go, jihadists to go there. So it could be al-Qaeda. It would be reminiscent of their tactics elsewhere. What impact does this have on the urban elites? I think it just frightens them. It frightens them that all hell's going to open up if this revolution – it makes them more conservative in some ways. I think that elites in some ways, rather than join the revolution as violence spreads, are either hunkering down and perhaps some of them are hoping that there'll be a counter-revolution, that the government will get control of this. Mm-hmm. And some of them are leaving, but others are leaving because they just say, oh, boy. Here we go. This happened in Iraq, Lebanon, 15 years of civil war. I can't subject my family to it.
Yeah. Well, that would make sense that people would either they would say, well, we have to leave the country. But if that they were going to stay, that would
I think it would
circle the wagons even more. They would be more supportive of the government rather than.
Well, I think many of them are. I think, you know, Al-Qaeda is in a sense gambling that this is going to unravel the government's. In a sense, its legitimacy is based on being able to protect security in these two major cities. Mm-hmm. And it's proving that the government can't do it. It's not in control, that this kind of thing is going to happen. And it gives courage, I suppose, to revolutionaries who think, you know, we're taking the fight to downtown Damascus and Aleppo. These rich, spoiled people are not going to get a pass on this. It's not just country people who are going to die. And we're going to punish them. So there is an element of that to it as well. It's hard to know how it comes out in the end. And the government, you know, part of this sort of tactic, insurgent tactic, is to get the government to respond in a way over-the-top way, which then undermines its legitimacy even more and horrifies the people. And that's what the government has been doing in places like Homs and so forth, which is pounding the inner city, mm-hmm. killing all these innocent people. And it just has horrified the country, and particularly Sunnis who put up with the government for a while, thinking maybe they'd get back control. But most people are abandoning it. And so the government overreach, this it causes a counter-reaction. And that's where the civil war element begins to yawn. You know, you begin to look into the mouth of this civil war situation.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. We'd certainly welcome others. Again, the number, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The caller's in Effingham on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I have a statement and then a question. The so-called Arab Spring, which is supposedly producing a new social paradigm, in my opinion, will turn out to be the same old 7 and 6, and the class society will regain some elements of the old and some of the new, will regain power and go right back to the same things that have been going on since post or pre-colonialism, really, except it was kings and queens then. But my opinion is that nothing's going to change in the long run. And the so-called Arab Spring, the question is, does your guest have any knowledge or anything to say about NGOs? And I'll ring off. Thank you.
Well, I think there's a lot of skepticism about the Arab Spring. There was a lot of hope, but there are many dangers out there. And if you look at the economic numbers, they've been moving in the wrong direction for the Middle East at large. And in the 60s, most of these regimes, authoritarian regimes, set up what political scientists call an authoritarian bargain. In other words, they took away the freedoms. People had to give up their freedoms, but they got government jobs, sort of socialism, subsidized food products, and narrowing the income gap that had divided the Middle East. That authoritarian bargain began to collapse in the 80s. It led to open-door policies in Egypt, privatization, the collapse of socialism, and Syria held on to it the longest and through brute force. But that has been exploding from one end of the Middle East to the other, and in part that's because of bad government policies of not investing in education, not getting a free market economy that would encourage development. And so you see a lot of bad numbers, a lot of deep poverty, and you wonder how are these new governments that are going to be largely Muslim Brotherhood going to attract investment, going to get clear economic plans. And this is a big challenge, and it leads to a lot of skepticism, as we hear from your caller. There's no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. Now, what role NGOs can play? I don't – clearly, the United States right now has had trouble with these NGOs in like the IRI, the International Republican Institute and so forth that were created by Reagan and trying to promote anti-Muslim Brotherhood sort of liberal parties and so forth. And it's quite clear that the Muslim Brothers and the military both didn't like that very much and have punished them for it.
Yeah. In Egypt, we're talking
about. In Egypt. Yeah. So what role those sorts of NGOs have, I'm not sure. But there are a lot of other NGOs that are working like mad, particularly helping refugees in around Syria and so forth that are having an important impact.
Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here we have someone in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
You'd mentioned the possibility of perils with Iraq, but I wonder about more direct connections. Stop me if you've been through this. Is it not true that there are a couple of million externally displaced refugees, and a large number of those are in Syria? I wonder what is happening to them. In the turmoil in Syria. Well, I'll stop with that. What's
so
happening?
You mean Iraqi refugees?
There
were
about a million.
Yeah.
Okay.
Syria. Yeah. Yeah.
There are about half a million Palestinian refugees in Syria from the 1948 war and 67 war. And there are close to a million. There were close to a million Iraqi refugees at the height of that refugee problem, and many of them stayed in Syria and still remain in Syria because the situation in Iraq is economically was worse until recently. It depends on which area you are, but still, if you're in Damascus working in a restaurant or something in Damascus or Aleppo, you might stay there until the situation really deteriorates. That has been a big problem. And many of those refugees, about 300,000 of them, were Iraqi Christians who fled Iraq once Islamic groups took over and made life. And, of course, also criminality exploded in Iraq. So Christians were very easy targets. They were usually richer. You could kidnap their kids and get money for them. Their churches were attacked. And this has caused a lot of fear amongst serious Christians, about 8 to 10% of the population, who support the government by and large. Not all. There are many Christians who've spoken out in favor of democracy and the revolution. But by and large, the Christian community has clung to the Alawites and other minorities because they've been very fearful. And that Iraq example has exacerbated those fears and is making this a much tougher revolution.
What's the economic situation of the refugees,
boy,
the Iraqis and Palestinians? I mean, I had been hearing that they were generally unable, forbidden to work as foreigners.
That's all.
Social supports, or are they able to work around the edges, or how do they live?
Well, the Palestinians are allowed to work. In Lebanon, they're not. The Lebanese never gave them the right to work. But in Syria, they have all the rights of Syrians except the right to vote, and I'm not sure what that really gets most Syrians. But the Palestinians are fairly well set up. There's some discrimination against them in Syria, but they have integrated very well, and many have intermarried. The Iraqis are not supposed to work, but they do. You go to any restaurant, hotel, so forth in Syria, in downtown Damascus or in Aleppo, and you'll find tons of Iraqis as servers. You know, they're the Mexican illegals, and everybody's employing them because they work for less.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We're talking in this hour of Focus about recent developments in Syria with Joshua Landis from University of Oklahoma. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House at Green and Lincoln, 3 blocks from the Engineering Quad. Hendrick House rooms are large, carpeted, and air-conditioned with semi-private baths. Meals are served in its gold LEED-certified dining area. More information is available at hendrickhouse.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the second hour today, we'll talk about some of the privacy issues involved in the increasing use of drone aircraft, unmanned craft. Generally here, what we're talking about is things that just carry cameras, not weapons as the military uses, but the possibility that here in the United States, security departments, police departments, maybe even private individuals will be using these things, and that certainly do raise privacy issues. We'll talk about that in the next hour with Catherine Crump, a staff attorney, Jay Stanley, a senior policy analyst with the American Civil Liberties Union. They co-authored a report that the ACLU put out in December on this subject. And then on our program tomorrow, in the second hour of the show, we'll talk with Charles Duhigg. He's an award-winning investigative reporter with the New York Times. And we will talk about a recent book that he's authored. The title of the book is The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. We're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon. We have 10 different topics every week. You can check the schedule by going to the website, WILL.illinois.edu. You can find us on Twitter at Will Public Media and also on Facebook. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Joshua Landis. He's a professor in the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma, has been for many years now following politics of Syria. We have talked with him before on this program. He's always been a guest on telephone, and we're very happy to have him here in studio with us as he's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll be giving a talk in the MillerCom series about Syria this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the campus in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. This is a MillerCom event. It is free and open to anyone who would like to attend, so you can certainly stop by. And on this program, questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have some other callers, and we'll go again to someone in Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
What is the very first caller that came in almost touched on an idea that I've been asking for the last 10 or more years. What's the chance that we're simply repeating one of the multitude of occupations by different imperialist dynasties, the Romans, the Persians, the Arabians, and down the line, and then most lately, as far as I'm concerned, the vast collection of Europeans who've installed a military base in the thing that they now call Israel, just to keep the area stirred up so that it can be exploited most easily.
Well, there's, you know, many people in the region do accuse the United States of being the hegemonic power, if you will, in the Middle East. And I suppose if you want to look at it in terms of sort of big geostrategic movements, ever since the Second World War, the Middle East has become extremely important for the United States because...
And even before the First World War.
Yes, for the First World War, it was really Britain that was that was the major power broker there.
Yeah. And then you pop in the Germans, the Russians...
Sure.
The Belgians have been they haven't been there, I think.
Right. Well, the Belgians haven't played a big role, but the United States, for the United States, in many ways, if you want to, I think, helpful way to think about it is that Hitler was defeated in the Second World War because he was denied oil, and his, you know, both the tank units and his air force were grounded and came to a halt because they couldn't get any more fuel. And the reserves under the Persian Gulf and around the Persian Gulf in Arabia, Iraq, Iran are the major fuel reserves of the world. And the United States...
Thank goodness there's a chance that real information might dispute that idea. That there's more oil in the world than just in that pot.
Well, certainly there's more, but it's very important. And the United States has spent a lot of money and energy trying to be the broker of that of security in that region. In 79, we lost our bases in Iran with the Islamic Revolution. And we doubled down on Saudi Arabia and built up Saudi Arabia as a major center for military control in the region. In Iraq, in 2003... I think after 9/11, we were worried that Saudi Arabia might fall. And that was partly some of the incentive for the invasion of Iraq was to hedge our bets against the Saudi potential disorders in Saudi Arabia. Now, the Iraq effort didn't turn out very well, and we're back to relying on Saudi Arabia. So our strategic position in the Gulf region is really dependent on Saudi Arabia today. But I think that, by and large, the Obama administration is trying to withdraw and really work down U.S. presence in the Middle East because the occupations of Iraq, Afghanistan were untenable. We thought that we could make a friendly Middle East that would be pro-American and that would keep the region in our orbit. But it turned out to be much more difficult. And I think that for the Syria, that has very important ramifications because the West, and particularly the United States, doesn't want to get into Syria. It's worried that it'll get sucked into another long, complicated battle that it will be inconclusive. And we've, in a sense, learned the lesson of the last decade, which is that we can't control the outcomes of these nation-building efforts. We can't pick winners in the Middle East.
We're coming into our last 10 minutes. I want to thank the caller for his comments. I got somebody else I want to get right here, too. But here at this opportunity, we have an opportunity to talk a little bit about what the international community has at least said. And I think that it suggests that the options seem to be pretty limited if we're specifically talking about Syria and that we're interested in stopping the violence. The international community, there's within the United Nations, there has been, I think, some strong sentiment for at least trying to pressure Mr. Assad to stop killing people and to move toward reform, but that it hasn't gone very far because the big players in here are divided, particularly United States and Europe on one side and Russia and China on the other.
Right. Well, and Kofi Annan, who has been designated the special UN person for Syria, is trying to broker a peace agreement. Assad has signed on for this agreement, but I don't think he's going to fulfill. It's going to be very difficult to broker a negotiated agreement settlement to this conflict because it is an ethnic struggle. It has those elements of a civil war. One side, both sides believe that time is on their side. The Assad regime believes that because the army has stayed true to it, China and Russia have vetoed in the UN, Iran is helping them with arms and money, that they are going to prevail and that a modern army is going to destroy this insurgency. It may take a long time, but they're going to come out on top. Now, the opposition also believes they're going to win because the entire Western international community has condemned Assad and said he's got to go. They've promised lots of aid. They haven't delivered on it yet. But they've put, most importantly, very severe economic sanctions on Syria. Now, they've talked a big game, the West has. It has done very little in terms of military intervention. So I think the opposition believes that time is on their side. They're 65. The Arab Sunnis are 65% of the population. They, in this day and age of popular revolt and democratic demands, that this minoritarian regime, the last one in the Middle East, cannot survive. That's what they're counting on, and they're counting on the West helping them to destroy it. And so they think time is on their side, and both are playing for time, and they're not trying to come to some middle ground. And that's partly because the Assads can't have a middle ground. Once they hand over power to a parliament, the Syrian people are going to demand that they go to jail. Yeah. And they're going to be dead. So they've got their backs against the wall, and they're fighting for what they believe are their lives. And that's going to make it very difficult to have a gentle, soft landing.
Another caller here to talk with in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I want to turn this conversation a little different direction. I want to ask about Assad and Syria and Israel. The Israelis obviously have stood back from all of this conflict in Syria, at least to the extent that the media can report it. And I wonder if, depending upon what's going to come out of it, of course, if Assad's regime continues, then one thing, and if he's overthrown, it's something else. But I wonder how this might affect the possibility of continued talks between Israel and Syria, which did occur earlier and kept on sort of starting, stopping, and getting some sort of resolution between the two of them. And what the fact that Israel has really stood out of this conflict and not gotten involved, is related to, both in terms of Sunni politics and Sunni states versus Shia and other factors in the Middle East. Right. And I'll listen on the air. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your excellent question. Obviously, the Syrian revolution presents a lot of dangers for Israel, but also a lot of potential benefits for Israel. On the benefit side, it would be, well, if you had a Sunni regime that came to power and was beholden to the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, it would reorient the major strategic alliances in the Middle East. Because today, what you have is Iran allied with Syria, supporting Hezbollah, this sort of Shiite crescent, as some people have called it. And, of course, Iraq is part of that, too, thanks to the U.S. intervention with the Shiites coming to the top and the Sunnis being deposed. So that has been the major source of resistance to Israel, and that's called the Resistance Alliance by Syria. So for Assad to fall could hurt Hezbollah a lot, hurt Iran, and be good, potentially, for Israel. On the other hand, it holds out certain dangers, because if there's civil war in Syria and al-Qaeda gets involved and the country breaks up and there's factionalism and increasing Islamic fundamentalism, that would not be good for Israel necessarily. In many ways, what is the status quo today is good for Israel. Syria is extremely weak. Hezbollah is on the ropes trying to defend itself and getting a black eye in terms of ideological, because it's supporting the dictatorship. Sunnis are turning against it everywhere. And Israel is not threatened by Syria in any way. Now, so, you know, I think Israel's been very quiet, in part because their official stand is they're on the side of the revolution and democracy in Syria. And I think a lot of people are, but they haven't spoken out about this situation. Now, could, if the revolution takes place and the Sunnis come to power and the Alawites are deposed, could that help bring about a peace agreement, and particularly on the Golan Heights, this contested hunk of Syrian territory which Israel captured in 67 and then more or less annexed a little bit later? And has settled 20,000 people on. Syria is going to be very weak for a long time to come. And if you just look at it in terms of balance of power, Israel's not going to want to give up the Golan Heights to a very weak country that can do very little for Israel. That's been the major problem. Israel's very powerful. Syria is very weak. Will Syria accept the fact that the Golan Heights is gone and make peace with Israel? That could happen. And Burhan Ghaliyun, who's the head of the Syrian National Council, just a few months ago made a big statement saying, if we win, we are not going to oppose Israel in any form military, in any military form. We will try to have diplomatic negotiations to get back to Golan, but we will not oppose Israel militarily. We'll cut relations with Iran and Hezbollah. This was music to Israel's ear. But he was attacked rather viciously by members in his own Syrian opposition party and other Syrians who said, how can you say that? Golan Heights is ours. So this is going to be – it's possible that a new Syrian government would be in need of help from the United States and Israel and would want to have a peace agreement so that they could get development money and move ahead with developing Syria, and that that could militate towards an acceptance of having lost the Golan Heights. But on the other hand, a weak Syrian government in the future might have to get its bona fides by playing on the Golan issue.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Joshua Landis from University of Oklahoma. We're talking about Syria. We'll be here for about another 6 or 7 minutes. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And as you have explained and we have discussed, there has been in the United Nations this a strong sentiment to try to put pressure on the Assad regime to change and institute reforms to stop this military crackdown on its opponents. And it seemed that the one country that was doing the most to hold back, to pull back on the reins there, was Russia. Now, I think recently they've to some extent they've gotten behind this current effort that's being led by Mr. Annan, Kofi Annan, to trying to bring this message to the Syrian government that says, look, you can't go on like this. Although the killing continued to go on while Mr. Annan was there in Damascus, what is the Russian interest here? Why should the Russians continue to want to support the Assad regime?
Syria is a longtime ally of the Soviet Union and presently Russia. Russia has in Tartus a port agreement for the Russian Navy that it's trying to rebuild. It's the only port agreement where the ships can be refitted on the Mediterranean. And Syria gives it a berthside seat on the Arab-Israeli conflict, which is always worth something because you can influence a lot of things that way. But mostly, I think it's because of a growing competition with the United States elsewhere, that this is leverage, and it's an anxiety about Iran, because if Syria goes down, the pressure is all going to focus on Iran. And China has invested billions of dollars in the Iranian oil and gas industry, as has India and others, because as America has embargoed Iran, it's the number two reserves for oil and gas, and China is trying to build its country, and it needs to get tons of energy, and it's getting it from Iran. So they don't want all those agreements, that investment in the Iranian government, to be brought down by the United States and to have all of those contracts taken over by the United States. That would be their sort of nightmare scenario. So that, it's a classic competition for power between Russia and China and America. It's a little bit like the Cold War. They're keeping their allies. They don't want to see America take them over and bring them into their sphere of influence.
Yeah. Now, there's another country in the region, and I think we probably talked about this too, that I think some people have said, well, there's a possibility for them to play a role and to have some leverage, and that's Turkey. Sure. And certainly they have an issue that they – a refugee issue that they have to deal with. But I think that some people have thought, well, you know, perhaps Mr. Erdogan and the Turkish government might be in some position to persuade the Assad government to do things differently. Is there – do you think any – positive role that Turkey could play in this?
Well, Turkey is already playing a very pro-American role in many ways. But the United States, I think, and Europe hope that Turkey would get out ahead of this and would perhaps even invade militarily, set up security zones, training grounds for the opposition, this sort of thing. Turkey, frankly, is not so foolish. they don't want to get stuck in the Syrian swamp any more than the United States or Saudi Arabia or anybody else does. And they've talked a good game. And Erdogan has said, I'm the champion of democracy in the Middle East. This dictator cannot stand. He had very good relations with Syria, but he reversed his position very quickly in order to stand on the side of democracy. And now, of course, Turkey is a big exemplar of Islam-light government. And the Sunni uprising has a lot of sympathizers in Turkey. Turkey is a big Sunni country. Now, there are Alawites also, and there are lots of Kurds. So it's a very complicated situation for Turkey. If Turkey were to – if Syria collapses, for example, 10% of Syrians are Kurds. Many of them would like to secede and stick the north – eastern part of Syria onto the Kurdistan in Iraq, and then have maybe 25% of Anatolia, of Turkey, join them in a greater Kurdistan. And that gives Erdogan and his people in Ankara little nightmares. So they don't want to see anything that's going to encourage Turkish separatism and the PKK, the communist, the Kurdish Communist Party, to begin to crank up terrorist actions. So they're very loath to get involved in this thing because there's many dangers for them.
Hmm. Well, we're coming down to we have a couple of minutes here. I go back to thinking about your talking about what maybe you know, the government of the United States, other governments in the region, government of Israel would really like to see happen, the kind of government that they would really rather have there in Syria. At the same time, nobody wants to do Libya in Syria. That just seems not on. There's no interest in the United States. Government does not want to do it. Europe does not want to do it. And maybe that wouldn't be the right thing to do anyway, but there's not that sort of interest. So then if you just look at this in cold, hard diplomatic terms and you say, this is our interest and this is what we'd like to see happen, how could you imagine the United States or Europe or anybody else actually intervening in a way that would be positive, that maybe would get that regime change if that's what you decide you want, but do it without all the negatives?
Well,
I mean, is there any way?
I don't know. The white elephant here is the Syrian opposition, which has been very fragmented and backbiting. The Free Syrian Army, called the Syrian National Council, which is the political umbrella group that Washington is talking to, a bunch of traitors because they wouldn't give them money. There have been a number of senior defections from the Syrian National Council, people who are saying that It's run like a dictatorship. It's as bad as the Assads they were accused of. So there's been tons of bickering. Now, the opposition is meeting in Istanbul as we speak, and then Clinton's going to come there and have a Friends of Syria meeting with them and try to get greater unity amongst the opposition. But nobody is going to help the Syrian opposition with arms and lots of money so long as there's so much infighting, because they don't know they want to pick a winner. And they don't want a situation like Libya, where we saw just yesterday 70 people killed because different militias in Libya were beginning to shoot at each other. And if you take out the dictator in order to open up civil war, nobody wants that. That's what we did in Iraq. That's what we've done in Afghanistan to a certain degree. And we haven't been able to nation build. And we haven't solved these problems. So to open up another Pandora's box in Syria, I think a lot of people are getting cold feet, and they're thinking, well, let the Syrians figure it out for themselves, which in some ways is saying let the dictator survive, which in a very cold, you know, calculated way is saying let Assad survive for another 2 years because we can't deal with this. And that's very possible that something like that will happen.
And which would no doubt result in continued bloodshed, which is also something that nobody wants to see.
It is. But, you know, then you begin to make these calculations of what's going to cause more blood. Taking out the regime and having a civil war? We did that in Iraq. Americans killed over 10,000 Iraqis in the first month and a half taking out the regime. But then killing spiked. Once the resistance started in the civil war and America had 100-something thousand troops, they were trying to stop the fighting. If there were no American troops, what would have happened? It's hard to know. And then you get stuck in. You get stuck there trying to heal these, you know, power-sharing governments, democracy. You get into this stuff, and we failed. We failed in Afghanistan. Are we going to try to do that in Syria? That's the danger, and I think that's what's giving Obama nightmares. He wants to intervene for humanitarian reasons, but he doesn't want to get sucked into a swamp.
Our guest, Joshua Landis, is professor at University of Oklahoma. He'll be giving a talk on the subject of Syria this afternoon on the U of I campus. This is an event in the MillerCom series this afternoon at 4 in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory. Anybody who's interested should feel welcome to attend. Thanks very much for being here.
Well, it's a great pleasure being here in the flesh with you, David.
Thank you.